It is Tuesday, October 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Pakistan tries to assist those affected by Monday's earthquake. We talk with our reporter on the scene.
But when I went there, I saw that the kind of damage we were expecting, the earthquake has not done that, and that is good for the people there.
The U.S. Navy sends a destroyer to challenge China's South China Sea claim. A musician and actress Zadia criticizes a French fashion magazine for altering her image. It's all ahead. Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif said Tuesday his government will make every effort to help those affected by Monday's magnitude 7.5 earthquake and will announce a relief package once authorities carry out a comprehensive assessment. Sharif held a meeting of high-level officials to hear reports on the damage and response since the earthquake struck northern Afghanistan's sparsely populated Badakhshan province. I spoke with reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad, Pakistan, about the earthquake damage. All right, Ayaz, now I believe that you were touring areas that authorities had told you that had been affected by the earthquake. What did you see?
Well, you know, as this was quite a strong earthquake that struck Pakistan and those northwestern areas in the country, everybody was obviously scared and expecting that Tuesday morning when the authorities will be able to come up with a clear assessment as to what's the extent of the damage. That's what prompted me to really go to these areas, and they are the district of Dir, Temargara, and the Bajor Tribal Agency, which is basically a district controlled by the federal government, and it used to be a militant-dominated area at one time. So these are the areas which were, according to the military and other authorities, civilian authorities, were the worst affected areas. So, but when I went there, I saw that the kind of damage we were expecting, the earthquake has not done that, and that is good for the people there because of the depth of the earthquake. It shows that people were really lucky in that area. I spoke to residents in Bajor area, and the way they were describing the scene after the earthquake shook them, that they were unable to even stand on their feet, and they just thought that, you know, the earth is going to split in two parts. And so this is the kind of description they gave me, but I did not see any material damage there. There were casualties, like in Bajor Agency, which is the tribal district. There were like 21 confirmed deaths, according to officials there, and around 100 people were wounded. But the damage is sort of scattered. You know, it's a mountainous terrain, and here and there you see, like, maybe every 3 or 4 kilometers, you see a house. Either the wall has collapsed or the roof has collapsed. But the kind of damage we witnessed back in 2005 on October 8th in that year, when the earthquake of similar magnitude struck northern Pakistan and that flattened towns after towns, I think we have had the same kind of earthquake on Monday. But thank God, I mean, that's what people were really praying and were happy and delighted that the damage, it hasn't caused that kind of extensive damage. Mm-hmm. And so far, what we have from the authorities is that the overall death toll still stands at 223, whereas more than 1,600 people have been injured.
And how far is this area from Islamabad?
Well, this is in terms of drive. It took us like 6 hours to reach there. It's about like 450 kilometers north of Islamabad. And this is, you know, mountains. You have to travel up on mountains and then, you know, through valleys to reach this area. It's a beautiful part of Pakistan, really scenic part, you know, and you have a lot of beauty in that part of Pakistan. So it's a good journey, but the way we were traveling and we were going there, we were expecting some massive damage and major casualties. But as I said, that hasn't happened. And that beauty and the area, most of it remains intact. But I will still be careful in predicting anything, whether there were any serious casualties or not, because still, there are areas very close to the Afghan border which are really treacherous mountains. And going up there even is difficult for the military. So whether the settlements there in those areas Whether they have survived, whether there have been casualties, I think maybe by the end of the day today or maybe tomorrow, the authorities will be able to give us some details. But as of this moment, they are also expecting and are indicating that the damage may not be that extensive.
Has there been any mention made so far of, you know, international relief, international agencies coming in to try to help in that region affected by the earthquake?
Well, these questions we have asked authorities here, the civilian and military authorities, but as of this moment, Pakistani officials are saying that they are well equipped and they don't need any international relief help because they have trained and they have created certain institutions after the 2005 earthquake that they have been able to put in place quickly mechanisms that would, you know, carry out that are already carrying out rescue work in affected areas. So we haven't seen any international aid agency coming into action, and it is not so easy for foreign agencies to work in this area, which has been infested by Islamist militants for very, very long time. Although due to recent military operations in those areas, the insurgency has declined, but still these are fragile areas, and it is from security point of view, you really need to be careful while working there. And I think at this moment, Pakistani army or civilian authorities would not want to take any risk of allowing foreign aid agencies to go and work there.
Okay, thanks very much, Ayaz. That's Ayaz Ghul reporting from Islamabad, Pakistan.
Thank you, Sarah.
My colleague Susan Yaki has been looking into what's going on in social media today and joins me here in the studio. Susan?
Hi, everyone. Once again, there is a lot of web chatter and photos about the South Asia earthquake. Dawn reports on Twitter that a reverse faulting at immediate depths about 210 kilometers below the Hindu Kush Range in northeastern Afghanistan caused Monday's earthquake in the Pak-Afghan region, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. Its headline, attributed to the survey, reads, Pakistan in the most active quake zone. Asim Yousafzai says, please be advised not to go inside a building with cracks. Stay outdoors. I'm expecting more aftershocks. Kamza Khan asked to retweet the advice of drop, cover, and hold in a quake. Aru Zara says, dear people, please remain safe, rush out of the buildings, and do not make videos. Your life is way more important. Sadat Yunus says, we have another challenge. Pakistan is struggling, alas. Javed Afridi tweets, time where you realize how life can just be a matter of few seconds. And there are many words of prayer. Anna Ahmed tweets, may Allah Almighty protect us from any kind of harm and give strength to recovery to injured and save the others. Nafisa Shah writes, the deadly quake has killed and destroyed life and property of many and praying for life and safety of the hundreds affected. Rubia Abrar says, my thoughts and prayers with all involved in the earthquake in Pakistan. May there be safety and sensible building planning for the future.
What else is happening on the web?
Well, another big story today is a U.S.-guided missile destroyer sailing within 22 kilometers of a reef claimed by China in the disputed Spratly Archipelago. GMA News Online says President Benigno Aquino says he sees no issue in the move. It quotes him as saying, we see no issue in this U.S. Navy ship traversing in waters that should be free to travel upon. So long as everybody conforms to international customs, rules, and regulations, then there shouldn't be any problem. Nine Dash Line writes, business should care about the South China Sea dispute, as conflict could see almost one-third of global trade at risk. Constantino Xavier tweets, South China Sea dispute is a laboratory to observe how China defines and pursues its interests. Sarah?
Thanks very much, Susan. That's International Edition Susan Yaki. Well, for more on that dispute in the South China Sea, a U.S.-guided missile destroyer Tuesday sailed within 22 kilometers of that reef in the disputed Spratly Archipelago. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
The USS Lassen approached Subi Reef, occupied by China and also claimed by Taiwan, Vietnam, and the Philippines. The foreign ministry in Beijing accuses the vessel of illegally entering its waters, posing a threat to Chinese sovereignty. It says the Navy ship was monitored, followed, and warned. A U.S. military source says the mission was completed without incident. Sheila Smith, senior fellow for Japan Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, says the U.S. Navy's challenge to China comes amid increasing rhetoric from Beijing about the need to defend its sovereign territory.
That suggests that they are not ready to peacefully resolve these disputes, that in fact their buildup and the presence of Chinese military on these islands suggests that they want a fait accompli. They just simply want to occupy the islands.
About 200 Chinese troops are believed to be stationed on Subi Reef in the South China Sea, which is naturally above water only at low tide. Smith says Chinese construction projects on low-lying reefs in the sea are seen as an attempt to assert air superiority or dominance there.
As you know, around the edge of the South China Sea are countries that don't have the capacity to compete with China's growing naval and air power.
Thus, analysts predict the U.S. Navy will continue such patrols, which are in line with its long-standing practice of freedom of navigation in international waters. In Manila, President Benigno Aquino told foreign correspondents,
any movement through this particular body of water should not be hampered by any entity.
And Japan is repeating its expression of concern about China's actions in the disputed waters. Chief Cabinet Secretary Yoshihide Suga, when asked about the U.S. missile destroyer's movement near China's ocean platform, replied that Tokyo is closely coordinating its intelligence information with the United States. A statement from Australia's Defense Minister, Maurice Payne, says Canberra strongly supports the right of all states under international law to have freedom of navigation and freedom of overflight, including the South China Sea, but adds that Australia is not involved in the current United States activity in the South China Sea. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
An international team of researchers have discovered a cosmic bartender hurtling through space at a speed of about 22 kilometers per second. Researchers say that as Comet Lovejoy sped past the sun last January, it pumped out large amounts of the same kind of alcohol used here on Earth to make cocktails, along with a type of sugar, into space. At its peak, the boost-producing ball of ice and rock released an amount of alcohol every second that was equivalent to at least 500 bottles of wine. The scientists say that the comet emitted a gas that contains some 21 different kinds of organic molecules that play an important role in creating some of the key ingredients for life. The discovery provides more evidence for a theory that the material needed for the creation of life is carried and delivered by comets. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a musician complains about a French magazine altering her image. Indonesian President Joko Widodo, on his first state visit to the United States Monday, committed to joining the 12-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, Free Trade Agreement of Pacific Rim countries. Mr. Widodo spoke through an interpreter.
Indonesia is an open economy, and with the 250 million population, we are the largest economy in Southeast Asia.
And Indonesia bermaksud untuk bergabung dengan TPP.
And Indonesia intends to join the TPP.
The trade pact aims to cut tariffs and streamline trade rules among nations accounting for 40% of the world's economic growth. However, the Indonesian leader faces stiff opposition at home. The country is among the lowest ranking on the World Bank's ease of doing business list. Don Emerson, director of the Southeast Asia program at Stanford University, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the Indonesian leader's endorsement may enhance the chances of passage of TPP in the U.S. Congress.
Symbolically, the statement that Jokowi made does certainly strengthen the momentum on the TPP. The fact that the largest country in Southeast Asia, and a democracy to boot, the fact that its president has expressed support for the TPP might make it easier for the TPP to pass the U.S. Congress. He will run into such flack politically back in Indonesia that they will say, no, this is an effort to export American standards and open up Indonesia to economic penetration by the West, by the United States. there's a public responsibility over the land and water and the resources, in effect, in Indonesia, which implies a kind of semi-socialist regime in which the kinds of entrepreneurship and openings for the private sector that the TPP is in a way all about would be certainly unorthodox and perhaps even anathema. So there will be a backlash, I'm certain. Indonesia's economy is slowing. It's not doing well. There's a general understanding, I believe, certainly among the people who lead the Indonesian economy, both in terms of people in the cabinet, as well as commentators in universities, business people in the private sector. They realize that the steps that Indonesia has recently taken in the last year or so that basically shut down access or reduce access to the Indonesian economy. And to the extent that people in the government recognize that and are willing to use the TPP, here's the critical argument, as an external excuse to engage in domestic reform, it seems to me that the TPP could play that role in which the government could say, look, we want to be part of the world economy. Our economy at home is not doing well. We need to reduce corruption. We need to improve efficiency. And joining the TPP and trying to meet its standards will enable us to engage in economic reform at home that will benefit Indonesia.
What would joining TPP do for Indonesia's relations with China, which is an even bigger trading partner?
China also has changed its view of the TPP. I think that there is a serious consideration in Beijing underway to join the TPP. I'm noticing that the Chinese position on the TPP is becoming more welcoming, just as I think is happening in Indonesia. Otherwise, Jokowi would not have made the commitment that he did.
That's Don Emerson of Stanford University. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
My name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Musician and actress Zendaya recently criticized a French fashion magazine for altering her image after a photo shoot. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about the issue, which has the 19-year-old singer taking on the images of beauty, both thin and not so thin.
Shauna, Zendaya is a beautiful young woman, and yet when she was in this model shoot for Modeliste magazine, they photoshopped her to make her a little bit more zoftig, a little rounder, you know? It was like she's a thin young woman.
She is. And keep in mind, she is also a young woman. She's also very tall. So, and this is something that she's talked about in the past, the fact that she felt a little insecure about being as tall as she is and as thin as she is. So I think that's what prompted her reaction after seeing the touched images that were to appear or that did appear in this magazine.
And the shot in question, she's in briefs and a black leather jacket, and she's kind of in the traditional S shape that they put fashion models in. But they made her hips and her thighs a little rounder, a little thicker. And was that to appeal to a certain audience, or did they just think she was too skinny, or what?
Well, I think it's probably a combination of both. There are differing standards of beauty, and they change as time goes on, as time changes. And now we know that a slightly more curvaceous body is more appealing, and it has always been to men. And I think that that, again, is a problem, that we're talking about a young girl that they were attempting to alter in a way that could potentially make it more appealing to older men, but also to set this standard, I think, for young women. And that's what magazines are. setting unrealistic standards for young women in fashion magazines, music videos, everywhere, really.
Everywhere I go, play you everywhere I go. Put you on repeat, play you everywhere I go. Everywhere I go, play you everywhere I go.
There was an article a couple of days ago about a woman who is slightly curvaceous, who gave her husband a photo book of boudoir photography.
I saw that, yeah.
And he said, I don't like it.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like my wife, you know. And so the photoshopping of this image, which she intended to be kind of an idealized version of herself, he didn't like.
Yeah, it took away. And I thought it was beautiful what he said, because he's like, you know, you erased our life together.
Yeah.
You know, you erase the children that we have. You erase the laugh lines. You've erased everything. And it's even worse now, because before, that was just something that you saw in magazines. That was the standard for people who were in the public eye. Now, with all of these apps and everything, anyone, I mean, I do it sometimes. If I take a picture and I'm like, oh, you know what? I don't like that. Filter it. Or, you know, you can now Photoshop your own body and extend it and do all kinds of stuff. So, I mean, really, I like what she's doing, because at the end of the day, it's like, you know, when you walk down the street, we all see what you look like in
the
real world anyway. You look like you.
Okay. All righty. Yeah. Well, if you have any comments on this, please send them to us. You can tweet to Shauna at VOA Lady DJ. You can tweet to us at VOA underscore IE. You can also comment on our webpage. That's voanews.com.
The music of Zendaya. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Gender-based violence is a scourge from which no country is immune. It is estimated that globally, one out of three women faces violence during her lifetime for no other reason than her gender. As unfortunately commonplace as gender-based violence is under normal circumstances, it increases exponentially during conflict, natural disasters, and other humanitarian emergencies. In emergency situations, societal structures break down, and women and girls in particular face an increased risk of gender-based violence, including sexual exploitation and abuse, rape, domestic violence, forced marriage, and trafficking. That is why 2 years ago, representatives of a number of governments, transnational organizations, NGOs, and civil society organizations met in London under the leadership of the United Kingdom to form a call to action on protecting girls and women in emergencies. The United States took on leadership of the call to action in 2014. As a commitment to the call to action, the United States announced its Safe from the Start program, an initiative that aims to address and reduce the incidence of gender-based violence in emergencies. We have used Safe from the Start funding to help our partners assist thousands of displaced Iraqis. Safe from the Start supported training for refugees from the Central African Republic on how to respond to sexual exploitation and abuse, setting up complaint mechanisms and emergency phone lines to report abuses. And in the Congo, we are helping to establish security patrol teams and install solar lights in communities so that women and girls are able to venture outside after sundown. At a ministerial on gender-based violence in humanitarian emergencies, a meeting co-sponsored by the United States and Sweden, Secretary of State John Kerry announced an additional $17 million for Safe from the Start. If we are to be successful in this effort, said Secretary Kerry, we need to take action. We need a zero-tolerance policy toward gender-based violence against anyone, men, women, and children. We must treat the survivors of violence with the sensitivity, respect, and the dignity that they deserve, and we must bring perpetrators to justice. Finally, to be successful, we must all work together. We have learned in painful and searing ways that gender-based violence can rip families apart, rip communities apart, and attack state structures. And too often, in too many countries, it perpetrates conflict and creates instability for generations, said Secretary of State Kerry. Preventing and dealing with the effects of gender-based violence is a fundamental moral issue. It's a basic question of right versus wrong.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.